welcome to episode 24 of the Anthrozoology Podcast. I'm Michelle Sidlowski.
I'm Chris.
In this episode, we speak with Sarah Oxlahini about both her rescue work and her academic research exploring cat abandonment in Saudi Arabia. This episode is the first of a two-part series on the subject. We will share a link to Sarah's paper in the information section of the podcast listing. Welcome, Sarah.
Hi, how's it going?
Great. Could you start by giving us a little background on what motivated you to take on the project?
Yeah, it was two-pronged, really. First of all, I went to live in Tobruk, Saudi Arabia in 2005. And prior to that, I'd come across some rescue cats. So cats, yeah, on an island, and I wasn't able to help them. So I'd made a promise that the next cat that I saw in need, I was going to help this cat. Anyway, so we were living on a compound and I saw a cat and it was in an absolutely dreadful state. Unfortunately, we were on the bus going to the airport to leave the country for a short break. So I swore when I got back, I would actually set something up to help the cats on the compounds to make sure that they weren't suffering quite so much. So at that time, there were no vets, as we would know vets in Tobruk. They're only pharmacists. And so in order to try and help the cats on the compound who were picked up, rounded up and dumped off the compound every so often because there was no trap new to release, I decided that I was going to find somebody who could help. So I managed to track down a vet who was working in Saudi Arabia as a volunteer vet, and she did TNVRM, trap neuter, vaccinate, release and manage. And so she ended up coming up every 3 months approximately, and we basically started a little MASH clinic. So it soon got around that people who were not on the compound wanted to come and have their pets seen to, who were on other compounds, other expats at the time. And I used that term because people were actually looking for work. They weren't moving there permanently. And then they got beyond that, and some of the local people heard about what's going on, and they wanted help for their cats, the cats mainly at that point. So what I did was I set up this volunteer network in 2005, started up as me. We'll meet Mohammed, who's in the second half of the podcast soon, and he's been working with me for the last 10 years. And there are a few other volunteers. But one of the things that we found difficult was actually, even though we recognized and networked with a lot of other rescuers within Saudi Arabia who were trying to help abandoned cats specifically, abandoned or cats in need who are living on the street, we found that we couldn't get authorities to listen to our voices or the cats' voices through our voices. There was just like an echo out there. There was just nobody really wanted to, or for whatever reason, there was nobody listening. And I've been trying to get people to understand the problem for quite some time. And it was only when I started my master's project in anthrozoology with Exeter University, when I had to do my dissertation, that I decided to use the case of abandoned cats in Saudi Arabia to try and understand why cats are abandoned on a regular basis. And there were a lot of overlaying factors, as we'll see. So what my hope is with this paper that I can now take it to a ministry official, try and get somebody to listen, and hopefully it will start a basis for some kind of understanding within the officials so that perhaps something can be done to help not only the cats who need help, but also, of course, society and society who don't want cats on the street and society who are finding difficulty in keeping their own pets or struggling to help other rescue animals within society, within Saudi Arabia, because nobody really knows what the causes of abandonment are.
So what were the key findings of your paper? Did you get any insight into some of these key factors?
So I've got a couple of diagrams I want to share in a moment, and maybe if you've got some questions on those, that'd be really interesting. But one of the key findings that I found was how, and this comes before the actual given reasons for abandonment versus the underlying factors for those actual given reasons, was that it's not possible really to tell the difference between a street living cat and an abandoned cat. And this is due to several factors. When I first started doing the research, and when I first was in Saudi, there are a lot of domestic short-haired cats. Those are the main cats that were being found on the street. And so in those senses, you could perhaps tell between a street living cat on a compound, which is where I first started, versus somebody who'd left their companion animal behind. And we'll get into that later, because of the friendliness. As time went on and more cats were brought into Saudi Arabia for selling as commodities, there became a proliferation of fluffy cats, for want of a better term. And I say fluffy because there's no pedigree system in Saudi, although a lot of people call these cats, a lot of people say mine's a Himalayan, mine's a Maine Coon, mine's a British Shorthair, all these different things. Mine's a Persian. There is no pedigree system. And so, of course, there's no actual knowledge of exactly what kind of breed, and I know we could discuss that in itself.
So I think a quick question. So that was interesting. What I just caught you say that these cats were brought in as a commodification, I guess, to be sort of sold as companion animals. So they're not being bought in by these migrant expats as family companions, so they're not bringing their family cat with them to work. They're actually moving there and then acquiring them.
Well, there's a whole raft of underlying things going on there. How these cats are actually brought in to the country, or how they arrived within the country, would be a whole other project to be looking at. But I can give you my best estimations. Firstly, yes, some expats do and did bring in their pets from overseas, their pets, their companion animals. I was among one of them. My cats, however, were sterilized. And of course, as a person who considers my cats as part of my family, I always had the intention to take them with me. Whether that happens with other expats is another question for another study. There are some issues which we come into about this, but another aspect is that there are definitely cats brought in from overseas that are then bred within pet shops or within households to be sold as a way of making money. Who brings them in? Not quite sure. Again, it would be looking at another study for that. But what we came to find in terms of these abandoned cats, and of course, over the years, we've got a massive network with different rescuers, and also there's a big social media presence, which there's lots of groups out there, etc. And you can see the differences in a street living cat that perhaps was originated from the region, with the long nose, the big ears, the kind of morphology of the face, which would help it to survive a hot environment, to various cats of different hair length, different hair color, fluffy, and the morphology of the different brachycephalic facial aspects, some of which don't create a great problem for the cats and some of which the more peaky-faced cats definitely create a problem. But even those peaky-faced cats, when I was doing part of my research and I was saying, well, they're definitely abandoned, I was in my conversations, the answer was, well, no, they're not definitely abandoned because it could be that somebody has thrown out their unwanted, thrown out is a colloquial term, thrown out in the, and dumped are two colloquial terms used in Saudi for abandoning cats. The cats could have been abandoned out on the streets, unsterilized. And so there could be a selection of brachycephalic kittens that are going around. So you can't tell. And even the aspects, if you're looking at a cat and you're deciding, okay, now we are saying that domestic shorthair doesn't necessarily mean it's a street. It's always been a street-living cat, a street-born cat, or a brachycephalic cat isn't always a pet. Even the terms of friendliness and the terms of approaching a human would vary depending on their own experiences. So a very shy or a defensive cat doesn't necessarily mean that it's not been in a home before. It depends on the experiences of being in that home, being put on the street, different adult changes it finds in terms of how is it going to get its food, how is it going to get its water, shelter, its trusting of humans, etc. The experiences that it has of any kind of abuse, which is deliberate or accidental. And a street-born cat might have been born in a particularly friendly area towards cats and may have actually have a friendly, developed a friendly personality because it's been treated well. So that's one of the main things that I discovered quite at the start was, even though my paper is about abandoned cats, it actually became obvious from the start that's not easy to definitely define the difference between an abandoned cat and a street-born cat. And of course, sorry to add, just because you've been born in the street and then you're taken into a home doesn't mean that you can go through that cycle several times, which does happen. And the same with a cat that's born in a home doesn't mean that they get to go through the cycle many times of in and out of homes on a constant and regular basis, which we do find.
I was going to say, so are cats typically on the compound, and I guess in the wider community, are they normally let out? Do they free roaming or?
Yeah, sorry. So there are cats all over Saudi Arabia. So if you imagine a compound like a vacuum, so it's not that they're in compounds and then they escape from the compounds. It's that there are cats all across Saudi Arabia, sorry, within cities, because Saudi has a very hostile environment for cats to live in, unless there's some kind of food and water source as a very, very basic minimum, and shelter as well, because the summers get up 40 plus degrees. But what compounds tend to do, and this has been going on for a long time, residents come from other countries, they end up on the compounds, or they either have to live on the compound, or they're encouraged to live on a compound, or they want to live on a compound, and they don't like, some of those residents might not like the cats that are living on the compound, whether or not they are within a managed colony, or whether they are just coming into the compound because there's a vacuum there. So what happens on a lot of these compounds is they get rounded up and they get taken somewhere. We don't know exactly where. There are rumors and conversations about that happening, but it's not usually somewhere where the cats are going to be able to live a good life. So there are cats all over Saudi, even in the cities. The compound managers often try to keep as clean, there's a power word, clean as possible. But then other cats just keep coming in. So there's a lot of lack of understanding. Sometimes, like if you have a managed colony, you are actually getting cats who are sterilized. Therefore, there's less spraying, there's less biting, there's less yowling, there's less kittens. They're fed, they're watered, so they're not searching for food in your house, they're not begging. And if there's shelter as well, then they're also not looking at your house for shelter. So there's all of that going on. But the streets, there's cats everywhere on the streets, absolutely everywhere. So So yeah, I mean, just going back to an example of not being able to tell that a cat is abandoned or not. I mean, I've got a cat, Foxy, who was rescued, and he has, something has happened to him in the past, and he is so afraid that he only trusts me. I'm one of the lady who wants him. He's frightened of men's legs. He's frightened of other people. We had guests the other week and they were in another part of the house, and Foxy was in this side of the house, absolutely terrified. You could see in his eyes. So if he went back on the streets for whatever reason, although I'm not in Saudi Arabia right now, you couldn't tell from his reaction whether he has actually been in the street before or not, or whether he's abandoned or not, if you see what I mean.
So what were the main reasons that you found for relinquishment or abandonment?
Okay. My methodology was talking to other rescuers, talking to a couple of vets, and actually using data that our rescue group had, because we have online adoption forms. And I took about 600 or something of those adoption forms and asked the questions, what would be the reasons that you would give up your cat? So there were different things feeding in here. So the reasons that, the actual given reasons were lack of facilities, family doesn't want them, too many cats, the cat is too old or not young or too young, traveling, allergies, the owner changed their mind, the owner was misinformed, finances, cat sexual behavior, euthanasia, being unprepared to have a cat, sterilization being haram, final exit, human pregnancy, and lack of facilities. And the factors which overlay this are lack of facilities, misinformation, lack of cat-related information, human expectations, changing human circumstances, humans have changed their minds, the cat's actions, changing cat circumstances, the cats are easy to obtain, there are no consequences in the abandonment, there's a normalization of cats being on the street, beliefs about cats or religious beliefs in general, and conflicts between beliefs and practices. Talking about these reasons in detail is something that I'd like to do on future podcasts. I'm going to give one example soon on final exit, but I think it's going to be useful talking to Mohammed in the next episode, who, as I've mentioned previously, is my fellow rescuer within our organisation, to give a flavour about how he feels of some of the reasons that are given to him through the many messages he and I both receive from people on a daily basis. And the reasons that I found in my research can be revisited at a later time in depth, because there's far too much to cover here today in just one episode. So if I can give you an example of final exit, this means that an expat is leaving the country of Saudi Arabia to go on to somewhere else. So this is a term that Saudis use, and it's a term that expat use, it's a term that companies use. So you have a visa to enter Saudi Arabia and a visa to work there, and then you have a visa when you exit. And once you've exited, you couldn't return. Now there's tourism visas, so there's a possibility to return now. Previously, you couldn't return that unless you reapplied for another job and got an entry visa to work. And what was happening is, there was a lack of information and a lack of people able to help people understand how to take their animals, their companion animals, outside of Saudi Arabia. So, for example, say I'm somebody from the UK who arrives in Saudi Arabia. I find a cat or I buy a cat. I want to take it back to the UK. People don't realise there's a whole process, and the minimum time of that process from taking a cat from the first rabies injection to being allowed to enter the UK is 4 months. Not only do you have to then prepare all of the documentation, which is quite complex and expensive, it can be expensive, but you also have to then arrange the flights. You had to talk to the airline. And on top of that, the UK only allows animals to enter into the UK by flight as a manifest cargo. So that's expensive. So that's one example. Another less rigid example is exactly the same terms in present preparation. But if you wanted to mainland Europe, you could take your animal as excess baggage or in the cabin if there's space on the airline, if the airline allows it, and it's much cheaper. And another example is going to the United States is one of the easiest. It's definitely one of the easiest for the cats. There's a minimum of 13 days for a cat to have a rabies injection. It's a very simple process. It's more complicated now because there's a ban on dogs going to Saudi Arabia unless they were owned by the owner. That's all in flux. So people were either not thinking about taking their animals with them, or they were thinking about it at the last minute and they're not realizing it's very, very complex. So one of the solutions we put in place to that is, and thankfully social media, we have, I think it's 26 next stop groups, which are Facebook groups, which have information in there about how to export your companion animal from Saudi Arabia to 26 other destinations, EU being one destination itself. And a lot of them are easy. Australia is very difficult. New Zealand is almost impossible. There are ways to do that. And that has really helped a lot of people take their companion animals with them, to the extent that the Filipina community are absolutely amazing. They have created at least a couple of their own groups after I started the Next Stop Philippines. And they have their own conversations in Tagalog, because of course I don't understand Tagalog, so I can't help people if they can't communicate with me or I can't communicate with them. And they take their pets back all the time. They're amazing rescuers. And so there's a lot of people who actually export their pets. It's very interesting.
So you've talked about a lot about expats. Is it predominantly the expats that are abandoning animals, or is this also seen in local communities?
It's both expats and locals that abandon cats. In terms of expats, for sure over the last 18 years, it became very normalized that people would just leave their cats behind, just leave their dogs behind. So some people wanted to do it and couldn't. And there are some people who just thought it was like having a new iPhone or something like that. When you no longer want it, you just leave it behind, leave your car, leave this, leave your house, leave the cat, and some really awful scenarios. That still happens. But now what we find is through the Facebook posts, people will say, my neighbors are leaving. They are about to abandon these cats. Can anybody help? And then I will be one of the people who says, where are they going? Can we help them? Is it about money? Is it about processes? Can we put them to the right group? That sometimes can help. And there are other people who say, is it just because of the amount of time that you need to prepare the animal? We can foster. We can help you do that while you prepare your paperwork, etc. And then if some people are absolutely determined that they don't want to take them with them, or they say they can't for various reasons, some which I do believe are genuine, some of which I don't, then there are some of them manage to get caught in the net of being caught with by rescuers. Perhaps another adoption, but we don't have any figures on how many then fall back through the net again. If we had a system where we could have a microchip on a cat, and every cat had to be before it was treated, had to be scanned, or if it was on a collar, it had to be scanned, we could start having some kind of tracking data on what happens to these animals. But that's just impossible. I'd love to do something like that. So yes, it's not just it's people of various cultural backgrounds, various ethnic backgrounds, various financial backgrounds. And sometimes it's down to finances. Sometimes it's down to this preparation. And sometimes it's down to the family not wanting the cat to be taken with them. Sometimes we get people very upset and they want their animal to be taken with them and they are just not allowed. That again, it could be due to a variety of reasons, sometimes depending on the reason, because we're going somewhere else and we don't know what kind of accommodation we have. We're going somewhere, I'm told we can't. And even when we try and get solutions to that, or contacting rescues in other countries that maybe they can look after them for a while, it's just some people just don't want to or are unable. So those animals end up being abandoned.
I wonder if part of it might be, or if you have any insight into, so like you said, on the compounds, there's these colonies and they may or may not be well managed, but you're sort of leaving and you're like, it's difficult to take your cat, but then you're like, oh, well, they're well looked after on the compound. They can carry on wandering about like they used to and somebody will take care of them. I mean, I'm not saying that's the reality, but maybe that perception and sort of with your work and groups that are sort of trying to make it better may actually be making it worse because the impression is, oh, well, they're probably better off being left behind.
Well, I don't deal with compounds anymore. I did work with one compound, a few compounds while I was there, and I'm basically set up Tion and VR on both of those compounds, and the cats were well looked after. Having left, nobody wanted to take it over. The company, the compound managers were interested. I'm no longer in touch with the people in those compounds, so I don't know how it is. I don't think it makes it worse because the perception for the last 18 years has been if somebody wants to leave their cat, they leave their cat. Because I lived on a British, a predominantly British community, and you know, we're known as pet lovers and all this kind of stuff. And you could tell when you spoke to somebody that they actually had no intention of taking their pet, whatever happens to the pet, even if you said, look, you know that this cat could live till the cat's 15, and you know what happens, you know, because you see it every day, just not interested. In fact, my first ever foster was a guy who wanted his cat fostering because he was moving to another compound in Riyadh, and he said, can you foster the cat? And I said, yes, of course I can. And I got excuse after excuse after excuse, and then he told me, I've got no intention of taking that cat, I'm not interested. So fostering is another big problem, because there are, we'll talk to Mohammed in the next episode, but that is a big problem because when people can't find outlets and when they feel guilty about leaving their cat on the street, and this is not only Saudi Arabia, I see it on lots of other social media groups. There's the threat of, if you don't take my cat, I'm going to put it on the street. And it's not meant if you don't take my cat, I've got no other option. I'm going to leave it on the street. If you don't take my cat, you are to blame. And that cat is going on the street. And whatever happens, that is down to you.
How does that make you as a rescuer feel? You know, that's a whole other episode, right?
And I absolutely would like to do that as an episode. And it's one of the questions that we had for as a rescuer. It pushes you to the limits because you're not only dealing with these hundreds of cats who you can't take them all and you can't look after them all. And they're all in a variety of states of either well-being or completely can't look after themselves and are suffering or dying on the street. You can't help them all. You have to decide which ones you are going to be able to help. There's a lack of people who want to join you to help. Or if they do want to join you to help, they have a very different way of looking at volunteering, more like can I go to shelter and play with the cats? I don't want to clean. I don't want to do medical stuff. I don't want to take to the vet. So, you know, and it's actually been more of a hindrance than a help. But when you're actually trying to not only create an environment where the animals are helped, and our charity is an animal-focused charity. We say that animal-centered, not human-centered. So if somebody calls and says they want us to get rid of take their cat, it very much depends on the reason, and it's very unlikely that we'll say yes. We'll always try and find a solution first. But when you're then attacked because you, A, can't help, or there are other alternatives and we just don't have the resources of the people, it just makes you feel either extremely fed up or very angry. So we go through these phases of, you can have great days and you can have really bad days, and it's just like anything really. But just seeing these animals suffering so much is very, very difficult. What is great is when an animal is then eventually adopted and there's a great story behind that and that and their life, then that's absolutely fantastic. For example, is a cat called Lovebug, who we rescued, and she was pretty much dead. She was found in a pool of liquids, and she literally couldn't lift herself. She couldn't raise. She was literally almost dying. We shaved her, and we treated her. And there's a video that went viral of Mohammed videoing himself with the cat, and I'll put the link to it on here. And she just looks up at him, and he looks down at her, and she reaches up as if to say thank you, and he just like puts his arms around her. That cat is now living in France, living her best life. So those kind of stories are fantastic, but it hardens you a bit, for sure. It hardens you.
So thank you for joining us today on the Anthrozoology Podcast. Maybe we can have you back again to talk a little bit more about cat abandonment in Saudi Arabia and the reasons behind it. On our next episode, we are going to be joined by Dr. Mohammed bin Ibrahim, and he and Sarah are going to talk about the day-to-day practicalities of dealing with cat abandonment in Saudi Arabia. Thank you again for coming to speak to us today.